good humor was a perverse mystery to him. Maybe it was some important bonding instinct to make sure their parents looked after them, like when they smiled at Mommy and Daddy practically from their first moment. Clever little critters, babies. "Jack, put a bottle on," Kathy said, heading with the little guy to the changing table. "Roger that, Doc," the intelligence analyst responded dutifully, doubling back into the kitchen for a bottle of the junk he'd mixed up the previous night. That was man's work, Kathy had made clear to him during Sally's infancy. Like moving furniture and taking out the garbage, the household tasks for which men were genetically prepared. It was like cleaning a rifle to a soldier. Unscrew the top, reverse the nipple, place bottle in pot with 4 to 5 inches of water, turn on stove, and wait a few minutes. That would be Miss Margaret's task, however. Jack saw the taxi outside the window just pulling onto the parking pad. "Car's here, babe." "Okay," was the resigned response. Kathy didn't like leaving her kids for work. Well, probably no mother did. Jack watched her head into the half-bath to wash her hands, then emerged to put on the suit coat that went with her gray outfit. Even gray cloth-covered flat shoes. She wanted to make a good first impression. A kiss for Sally, and one for the little guy, and she headed for the door, which Jack held open for her. The taxi was an ordinary Land Rover saloon car. Only London required the classic English taxi for public livery, though some of the older ones found their way into the hinterland. Ryan had arranged the morning pickup the previous day. The driver was one Edward Beaverton, and he seemed awfully chipper for a man who had to work before 7 a.m. "Howdy," Jack said. "Ed, this is my wife. She's the good-looking Dr. Ryan." "Good morning, Mum," the driver said. "You're a surgeon, I understand." "That's right. Ophthalmic..." Her husband cut her off. "She cuts up eyeballs and sews them back together. You should watch, Eddie. It's fascinating to see how she does it." The driver shuddered. "Thank you, sir, but no thank you." "Jack just says that to make people throw up," Kathy told the driver. "Besides, he's too much of a wuss to come watch any real surgery." "And properly so, Mum. Much better to call surgery than to attend it." "Excuse me? You're a former Marine?" "That's right. And you?" "Well, I was in the parachute regiment. That's what they taught us. Better to inflict harm on the other bloke than to suffer it yourself." "Most Marines would agree with that one, pal," Ryan agreed with a chuckle. "That's not what they taught us at Hopkins," Kathy sniffed. It was an hour later in Rome. Colonel Godarenko, titularly the second secretary at the Soviet embassy, had about 2 hours per day of diplomatic duties, but most of his time was taken up by his job as resident, or chief of station for the KGB. It was a busy posting. Rome was a major information nexus for NATO, a city in which one could obtain all manner of political and military intelligence, and that was his main professional concern. He and his 6 full and part-time officers ran a total of 23 agents, Italian and 1 German nationals who fed information to the Soviet Union for political or pecuniary reasons. It would have been better for him if their motivation was mainly ideological, but that was rapidly becoming a thing of the past. The Residentura in Bonn had a better atmosphere in which to work. Germans were Germans, and many of them could be persuaded that helping out their co-linguists in the DDR was preferable to working with the Americans, British, and French, who called themselves allies of the fatherland. For Godarenko and his fellow Russians, Germans would never be allies, whatever politics they might claim to have, though the fig leaf of Marxism-Leninism could sometimes be a useful disguise. In Italy, things were different. The lingering memory of Benito Mussolini was pretty well faded now, and the local, true-believer communists were more interested in wine and pasta than revolutionary Marxism, except for the bandits of the Red Brigade, and they were dangerous hooligans rather than politically reliable operatives. vicious dilettantes more than anything else, though not without their uses. He occasionally saw to their trips to Russia, where they studied political theory and, more to the point, learned proper fieldcraft skills that at least had some tactical use. On his desk was a pile of overnight dispatches, topmost of which was a message flimsy from Moscow Center. The header told him it was important, and the cipherbook, 115-890. This was in his office safe, in the credenza behind his desk. He had to turn in his swivel chair and half-kneel to dial in the combination to open the door, after first deactivating the electronic alarm that was wired to the dial. That took a few seconds. Atop the book was his cipher wheel. Godorenko cordially hated using one-time pads, but they were as much a part of his life as using the toilet. Distasteful, but necessary. Decryption of the dispatch took him 10 minutes. Only when it was done did he grasp the actual message. From the chairman himself, he thought. As with any mid-level government official across the world, it was like being called to the principal's office. The Pope? Why the hell does Yuri Vladimirovich care a rat's ass about getting close to the Pope? Then he thought for a second. Oh, of course. It's not about the head of the Catholic Church. It's about Poland. You can take the Polak out of Poland, but you can't take Poland out of the Polak. It's political. That made it important. But it did not please Godorenko. Ascertain and report means of getting physically close to the Pope, he read again. In the professional language of the KGB, that could only mean one thing. Kill the Pope? Godorenko thought. That would be a political disaster. As Catholic as Italy was, the Italians were not a conspicuously religious people. La dolce vita, the sweet life, that was the religion of this country. The Italians were the most profoundly disorganized people in the world. How they had ever been allies to the Hitlerites boggled the imagination. For the Germans, everything was supposed to be in Ordnung, properly arranged, clean, and ready for use at all times. About the only things the Italians kept in proper order were their kitchens and perhaps their wine cellars. Aside from that, everything was so casual here. To a Russian, coming to Rome was a culture shock, akin to being bayoneted in the chest. The Italians had no sense of discipline. You only had to observe their traffic to see that, and driving in it was what flying a fighter plane must be like. But the Italians were all born with a sense of style and propriety. There were some things one could not do here. Italians had a collective sense of beauty that was difficult for any man to fault, and to violate that code could have the most serious of consequences. For one thing, it could compromise his intelligence sources. Mercenaries or not, even mercenaries would not work against their very religion, would they? Every man had some scruples, even... No, he corrected himself, especially here. So the political consequences of something like this potential mission could adversely affect the productivity of his residentura and would seriously impact recruitment. So what in hell do I do now? He asked himself. A senior colonel in the KGB's first chief directorate and a highly successful resident, he had a certain degree of flexibility in his actions. He was also a member of a huge bureaucracy, and the easiest thing for him to do was what all bureaucrats did. He would delay, obfuscate, and obstruct. There was some degree of skill required for this, but Ruslan Borisovich Godorenko knew all he needed to know about that. Chapter 6. But not too close. New things are always interesting. And that was true for surgeons, too. While Ryan read his paper, Kathy looked out the train window. It was another bright day, with a sky as blue as his wife's pretty eyes. For his part, Jack had the route pretty well memorized, and boredom invariably made him sleepy. He slumped in the corner of the seat and found his eyelids getting heavy. "Jack, are you going to sleep? What if you miss the stop?" "It's a terminal," her husband explained. "The train doesn't just stop there, it ends there. Besides, never stand up when you can sit down, and never sit down when you can lie down." "Whoever told you that?" "My gunny," Jack said from behind closed eyes.
"Who?"
"Gunnery Sergeant Philip Tate, United States Marine Corps. He ran my platoon for me until I got killed in that chopper crash.
Ran it after I left, too, I suppose."
Ryan still sent him Christmas cards. Had Tate screwed up, that "killed" might not have been the limp joke he pretended it was. Tate and a Navy hospital corpsman second class named Michael Burns had stabilized Ryan's back, at the very least preventing a permanent crippling injury. Burns got a Christmas card, too. About 10 minutes to Victoria, Ryan rubbed his eyes and sat up straight.
"Welcome back," Kathy observed dryly.
"You'll be doing it by the middle of next week."
She snorted.
"For an ex-Marine, you sure are lazy."
"Honey, if there's nothing to do, you might as well use the time productively."
"I do."
She held up her copy of The Lancet.
"What have you been reading up on?"
"You wouldn't understand," she replied.
It was true.
Ryan's knowledge of biology was limited to the frog he'd disassembled in high school. Kathy had done that, too, but she'd probably put it together again and watched it hop back to its lily pad. She could also deal cards like a Vegas card sharp, a talent that flat amazed her husband every time she demonstrated it. But she wasn't worth a damn with a pistol. Most physicians probably weren't, and here guns were regarded as unclean objects, even by the cops, some of whom were allowed to carry them.
Funny country.
"How do I get to the hospital?" Kathy asked, as the train slowed for its last stop.
"Take a cab the first time."
"You can take the tube, too," Jack suggested.
"It's a new city.
It takes time to learn your way around."
"How's the neighborhood?" she asked.
"It came from growing up in New York and working in Baltimore's inner city, where you did well to keep your eyes open."
"Damn sight better than the one around Hopkins.
You won't be seeing too much gunshot trauma in the ER. And the people are as nice as they can be. When they figure out that you're an American, they practically give you the joint."
"Well, they were nice to us in the grocery store yesterday," Kathy allowed.
"But you know, they don't have grape juice here."
"My God, no civilization at all," Jack exclaimed.
"So get Sally some of the local bitter."
"You moron," she laughed.
"Sally likes her grape juice, remember, and high C cherry. All they have here is black currant juice. I was afraid to buy it."
"Yeah, and she's going to learn to spell funny, too."
Jack didn't worry about his little Sally. Kids were the most adaptable of creatures. Maybe she'd even learn the rules for cricket. If so, she could explain the incomprehensible game to her daddy.
"My God, everybody smokes here," Kathy observed as they pulled into Victoria Station.
"Honey, think of it as a future income source for all the docs."
"It's an awful and a dumb way to die."
"Yes, dear." Whenever Jack smoked a cigarette, there was hell to pay in the Ryan house. One more cost of being married to a doc. She was right, of course, and Jack knew it, but everyone was entitled to at least one vice. Except Kathy. If she had one, she concealed it with great skill. The train slowed to a halt, allowing them to stand and open the compartment door. They stepped out into the arriving rush of office workers. Just like Grand Central Terminal in New York, Jack thought, but not quite as crowded. London had a lot of stations laid out like the legs of an octopus. The platform was agreeably wide, and the rush of people politer than New York would ever be. Rush hour was rush hour everywhere, but the English city had a patina of gentility that was hard not to like.
Even Kathy would soon be admiring it. Ryan led his wife to the outside where a rank of cabs waited. He walked her to the first one in line. "Hammersmith Hospital," he told the driver. Then he kissed his wife goodbye. "See you tonight, Jack." She always had a smile for him. "Have a good one, babe." And Ryan made his way to the other side of the building. Part of him hated the fact that Kathy had to work. His mom never had. His father, like all men of his generation, had figured that it was the man's job to put food on the table. Emmett Ryan had liked the fact that his son had married a physician, but his chauvinistic attitude about a woman's place had somehow or other carried over to his son, despite the fact that Kathy made a lot more than Jack did, probably because ophthalmologists were more valuable to society than intelligence analysts. Or the marketplace thought so, anyway. Well, she couldn't do what he did, and he couldn't do what she did, and that was that. At Century House, the uniformed security guard recognized him with a wave and a smile.
"Good morning, Sir John."
"Hey, Bert." Ryan slid his card into the slot. The light blinked green, and Jack transited the security gate. From there, it was just a few steps to the elevator. Simon Harding was just arriving, too. The usual greeting. "Morning, Jack." "Hey," Jack grunted in reply on the way to his desk. There was a manila envelope waiting for him. The cover tag said it had been messengered over from the U.S. Embassy in Grosvenor Square. He ripped the top open to see that it was the report from Hopkins on Mikhail Suslov. Jack flipped through the pages and saw something he'd forgotten. Bernie Katz, ever the thorough doc, had evaluated Suslov's diabetes as dangerously advanced and predicted that his longevity was going to be limited. "Here, Simon. It says here the head commie's sicker than he looks." "Pity," Harding observed, taking it as he fumbled with his pipe. "He's not a very nice chap, you know."
"So I've heard."
Next in Ryan's pile were the morning briefing papers. They were labeled secret, which meant that the contents might not be in the newspapers for a day or two. It was interesting even so, because this document occasionally gave sources, and that sometimes told you if the information was good or not. Remarkably, not all the data received by the intelligence services was very reliable. A lot of it could be classified as gossip, because even important people inside the world's government loops indulged in it. They were jealous and backbiting sons of bitches like anyone else, especially in Washington. Perhaps even more so in Moscow? He asked Harding.
"Oh, yes, very much so. Their society depends so much on status. And the backstabbing can be... well, Jack, you could say that it's their national sport. I mean, we have it here as well, of course. But over there it can be remarkably vicious. Rather like it must have been in a medieval court, I imagine. People jockeying for position every bloody day. The infighting inside their major bureaucracies must be horrific."
"And how does that affect this sort of information?"
"I often think I should have read psychology at Oxford. We have a number of psychiatrists on staff here, as I'm sure you do at Langley."
"Oh, yeah. I know a few of the shrinks, mainly in my directorate, but some in S&T, too. We're not as good at that as we ought to be."
"How so, Jack?"
Ryan stretched in his chair. "A couple of months ago, I was talking to one of Kathy's pals at Hopkins. His name's Solomon, neuropsychiatrist. You'd have to understand, Sol, he's real smart, department chairman and all that. He doesn't believe much in putting his patients on the couch and talking to them. He thinks most mental illness comes from chemical imbalances in the brain. They nearly chopped him out of the profession for that, but 20 years later they all realized that he was right. Anyway, Saul told me that most politicians are like movie stars. They surround themselves with sycophants and yes-men and people to whisper nice shit into their ears. And a lot of them start believing it, because they want to believe it. It's all a great big game to them, but a game where everything is process and damned little of it is product. They're not like real people. They don't do any real work, but they appear to. There's a line in Advise and Consent. Washington is a town where you deal with people not as they are, but as they are reputed to be. If that's true in Washington, then how much more must it be in Moscow? There, everything is politics. It's all symbols, right? So the infighting and backstabbing must really be wild there. I figure that has to affect us in two ways. First, it means that a lot of the data we get is skewed, because the sources of the data either don't know reality, even when it jumps up and bites them on the ass, or they twist the data for their own ends as they process it and pass it on, whether consciously or unconsciously. Second, it means that even the people on the other side who need the data don't know good from bad. So even if we can figure it out, we can't predict what it means because they can't decide for themselves what the hell to do with it, even if they know what the hell it is in the first place. We here have to analyze faulty information that will probably be incorrectly implemented by the people to whom it's supposed to go. So how the hell do we predict what they will do when they themselves don't know the right thing to do? That was worth a grin around the pipe stem.
Very good, Jack. You're starting to catch on. Very little they do makes any bloody sense, objectively speaking. However, it isn't all that hard to predict their behavior. You decide for yourself what the intelligent action is, and then reverse it. Works every time, Harding laughed.
But the other thing Saul said that worries me is that people like that, who have power in their hands, can be dangerous sons of bitches. They don't know when to stop, and they don't know how to use their power intelligently. I guess that's how Afghanistan got started.
Correct.
Simon nodded seriously. They are captured by their own ideological illusions. They can't see their way clear of it. And the real problem is, they do control a bloody great lot of power.
I'm missing something in the equation, Ryan said.
We all are, Jack. That's part of the job.
It was time to change subjects.
Anything new on the Pope?
Nothing yet today. If Basil has anything, I ought to hear about it before lunch.
Worried about that?
Jack nodded soberly.
Yeah. The problem is, if we do see a real threat, what the hell can we do about it? It's not like we can put a company of Marines around him, is it? Exposed as he is. I mean, he's in public so much that you can't protect him.
And people like him don't shrink from danger, do they?
I remember when Martin Luther King got whacked.
Hell, he knew. He must have known there were guns out there with his name on them. But he never backed away. It just wasn't part of his methods to run and hide.
Won't be any different in Rome, buddy, and every other place he goes.
Moving targets are supposed to be harder to hit, Simon observed half-heartedly.
Not when you know where he's moving to a month or two in advance. If KGB decides to put a hit on a guy,
damn, I don't see much we can do about it.
Except perhaps to warn him.
Great. So we can laugh about it.
He probably would, you know. He's been through Nazis and communists for the past 40 years. What the hell is left to scare the guy with?
Ryan paused.
If they decide to do it, who pushes the button?
I should think it would have to be voted on by the Politburo itself in plenary session. The political implications are too severe for any one member, however senior, to try something like this on his own authority. And remember how collegial they are. No one moves anywhere by himself, even Andropov, who's the most independent-minded of the lot.
Okay, that's, what, 15 guys have to vote up or down on it. 15 mouths, plus staffs and family members to talk to about it. How good are our sources? Will we hear about it?
Sensitive question, Jack. I cannot
answer that one, I'm afraid. Can't, or can't, I'm not allowed to, Jack asked more pointedly.
Jack. Yes, we have sources of which I am aware, but which I cannot discuss with you.
Harding actually seemed embarrassed to say it. Hey, I understand, Simon. Jack had some of those himself. For instance, he couldn't even speak the words talent keyhole here, for which he was cleared, but which was no foreign. No talking about this one to a foreigner, even though Simon and certainly Sir Basil knew quite a bit about it. It was so perverse, because it mainly denied information to people who might have made good use of it. If Wall Street acted this way, all of America would be under the poverty line, Jack groused. Either people were trustworthy or they were not. But the game had its rules, and Ryan played by those rules. That was the cost of admittance into this particular club.
This is bloody good stuff, Harding said, flipping to page 3 of Bernie Katz's debriefing.
Bernie's smart, Ryan confirmed. That's why Kathy liked working for him.
But he's an eye doctor, not a psychiatrist, correct?
Simon, at that level of medicine, everybody is a little bit of everything. I asked Kathy. The diabetic retinopathy Suslov had is indicative of a major health problem. The diabetes messes up the little blood vessels in the back of the eye, and you can see it when you do an examination. Bernie and his team fixed it partway. You can't fix it all the way, and gave him back about, 75 to 80% of his sight. Good enough to drive a car in daylight, anyway, but the underlying health problem is a mother. It isn't just the small blood vessels in the eye, right? He's got that problem all over his body. Figure Red Mike will croak from kidney failure or heart disease in the next 2 years of the outside.
Our chaps think he's got 5 years or so, Harding offered.
Well, I'm not a doc. You can have some people talk to Bernie about it if you want, but everything is right there. Kathy says you can tell a lot about diabetes from looking at the eyeball.
Does Suslov know that?
Ryan shrugged. That is a good question, Simon. Docs don't always tell their patients. Probably less so over there. Figure Suslov's being treated by a politically reliable doctor of professorial rank. Here that would mean a top-drawer guy who really knows his stuff. Over there... Harding nodded.
Correct. He may know his Lenin more than his Pasteur. Did you ever hear about Sergei Korolev, the chief rocket designer? That was a particularly ugly incident. The poor bugger was essentially murdered on the table because two senior surgeons didn't like each other, and one wouldn't bail the other out when the boat began to leak badly. It was probably good for the West, but he was a fine engineer, and he was killed by medical incompetence.
Anybody pay up for that one? Ryan asked.
Oh, no. They were both two politically important lots of patrons in high places. They're safe, until they kill one of their friends. And that won't happen. I'm sure they both have competent young people under them to cover their backsides.
You know what they need in Russia? Lawyers. I don't like ambulance chasers, but I guess they do keep people on their toes.
In any case, no, Suslov probably does not know the gravity of his condition. At least that's what our medical consultants think. He still drinks his vodka, according to Hume Int reports, and that is definitely contraindicated.
Harding grimaced.
And his replacement will be Alexandrov, every bit as unpleasant a chap as his mentor.
I'll have to see about updating his dossier. He made a note. As for Ryan, he turned back to his morning briefing pages before starting on his official project. Greer wanted Ryan to work on a study of management practices in the Soviet armament industry to see how, and if, that segment of the Soviet economy worked. Ryan and Harding would be cooperating on the study, which would use both British and American data. It was something that suited Ryan's academic background. It might even get him noticed high up. The return message came in at 11:32 hours. Fast work in Rome, Zaitsev thought, as he began the decryption. He'd call Colonel Rozhdestvensky as soon as he got through it, but it was going to take a while. The captain checked the wall clock. It would delay his lunch, too, but the priority condemned him to some stomach growls. About the only good news was that Colonel Godarenko had started his encipherment sequence at the top of page 285. Most secret, immediate and urgent. From Resident Rome to Office of Chairman, Moscow Center. Reference, your op dispatch 15-8-82-666. Getting close to the priest is not difficult without fixed time constraints. Guidance will be needed for a full evaluation of your request. Priest engages in predictable public audiences and appearances which are known well in advance. To make use of this opportunity will not, repeat, not be easy due to large crowds attending functions. Security arrangements for him difficult to assess without further guidance. Recommend against physical action to be taken against priest due to expected adverse political consequences. Difficult to hide origin of an operation against priest. Ends. Well, Zaitsev thought, the resident didn't like this idea very much. Would Yuri Vladimirovich listen to this bit of advice from the field? That, Zaitsev knew, was far above his pay grade. He lifted his phone and dialed. Colonel Rozhdestvensky, the brusque voice answered. Captain Zaitsev in Communications Central. I have a reply to your 666, Comrade Colonel.
On my way, Rozhdestvensky responded.
The colonel was as good as his word, passing through the control point 3 minutes later. By that time, Zaitsev had returned the cipher book to central storage and slipped the message form plus the translation into a brown envelope, which he handed to the colonel.
Has anyone seen this? Rozhdestvensky asked.
Certainly not, comrade, Zaitsev replied.
Very well.
Colonel Rozhdestvensky walked away without another word. For his part, Zaitsev left his work desk and headed off to the cafeteria for lunch. The food was the best reason to work at the center. What he could not leave behind as he stopped at the lavatory to wash his hands was the message sequence. Yuri Andropov wanted to kill the Pope of Rome, and a resident in Rome didn't like the idea. Zaitsev wasn't supposed to have any opinions. He was just part of the communications systems. It rarely occurred to the hierarchy of the Committee for State Security that its people actually had minds, and even consciences. Zaitsev took his place in line and got the metal tray and utensils. He decided on the beef stew and 4 thick slices of bread with a large glass of tea. The cashier charged him 55 kopecks. His usual luncheon mates had already been and gone, so he ended up picking an end seat at a table filled with people he didn't know. They were talking about football, and he didn't join in, alone with his thoughts. The stew was quite good, as was the bread, fresh from the ovens. About the only thing they didn't have here was proper silverware, as they did in the private dining rooms on the upper floors. Instead, they used the same feather-light zinc aluminum as all the other Soviet citizens. It worked well enough, but because it was so light, it felt awkward in his hands. So, he thought, I was right. The chairman is thinking about murdering the Pope. Zaitsev was not a religious man. He had not been to a church in his entire life, except those large buildings converted to museums since the revolution. All he knew about religion was the propaganda dispensed as a matter of course in Soviet public education. And yet, some of the children he'd known in school had talked about believing in God, and he hadn't reported them, because informing just wasn't his way. The great questions of life were things he didn't much think about. For the most part, life in the Soviet Union was limited to yesterday, today, and tomorrow. The economic facts of life really didn't allow a person to make long-term plans. There were no country houses to buy, no luxury cars to desire, no elaborate vacations to save for. In committing what it called socialism on the people, the government of his country forced everyone to aspire to much the same things, regardless of individual tastes, which meant getting on an endless list and being notified when one's name came up, and being unknowingly bumped by those with greater party seniority, or not, because some people had access to better places. His life, like everyone else's, was like that of a steer on a feedlot. He was cared for moderately well and fed the same bland food at the same time on endlessly identical days. There was a grayness, an overarching boredom to every aspect of life, alleviated in his case only by the content of the messages which he processed and forwarded. He wasn't supposed to think about the messages, much less remember them. But without anybody to talk to, all he could do was dwell on them in the privacy of his own mind. Today his mind had just one occupant, and it would not silence itself. It raced around like a hamster in an exercise wheel, going round and round, but always returning to the same place. Andropov wants to kill the Pope. He'd processed assassination messages before. Not many. KGB was gradually drifting away from it. Too many things went wrong. Despite the professional skill and cleverness of the field officers, policemen in other countries were endlessly clever and had the mindless patience of a spider in its web. And until KGB could just wish a person dead and have it come to pass, there would be witnesses and evidence, because a cloak of invisibility was something found only in tales for children. More often he processed messages about defectors or suspected would-be defectors, or, just as deadly, suspicion of officers and agents who'd doubled, gone over to serve the enemy. He'd even seen such evidence passed along in message form, calling an officer home for consultations from which they'd rarely returned back to their residenturas. Exactly what happened to them, that was just the subject of gossip, all of it unpleasant. One officer who'd gone bad, the story went, had been loaded alive into a crematorium, the way the German SS was supposed to have done. He'd heard there was a film of it, and he'd talked to people who knew people who knew people who'd seen it. But he had never actually seen it himself, nor met anyone who had. Some things, Oleg Ivanovich thought, were too beyond the pale even for the KGB. No. Most of the stories talked of firing squads, which often fucked up, so the stories went, or a single pistol round in the head, as Lavrenti Beria had done himself. Those stories, everyone believed. He'd seen photos of Beria, and they seemed to drip with blood. And Iron Felix would doubtless have done it between bites of his sandwich. He was the kind of man to give ruthlessness an evil name. But it was generally felt, if not widely spoken, that KGB was becoming more kulturny in its dealings with the world, more cultured, more civilized, kinder and gentler. Traitors, of course, were executed, but only after a trial in which they were at least given a pro forma chance to explain their actions, and, if they were innocent, to prove it. It almost never happened, but only because the state only prosecuted the truly guilty. The investigators in the Second Chief Directorate were among the most feared and skilled people in the entire country. It was said they were never wrong and never fooled, like some kind of gods. except that the state said that there were no gods. Men, then, and women. Everyone knew about the Sparrow School, about which the men often spoke with twisty grins and winking eyes. Ah, to be an instructor, or better still, a quality assurance officer there, they dreamed, and to be paid for it. As his Irina often noted, all men were pigs. But, Zaitsev mused, it could be fun to be a pig. Kill the Pope? Why? He was no threat to this country. Stalin himself had once joked, how many divisions does the Pope have? So why kill the man? Even the resident warned against it. Godorenko feared the political repercussions. Stalin had ordered Trotsky killed and had dispatched a KGB officer to do it, knowing that he'd suffer long-term imprisonment for the task. But he'd done it, faithful to the will of the party, in a professional gesture that they talked about in the academy training classes, along with the more casual advice that we really don't do that sort of thing anymore. It was not, the instructors didn't add, kulturni. And so, yes, KGB was drifting away from that sort of behavior. Until now. Until today. And even our senior resident is advising against it. Why? Because he doesn't want himself and his agency and his country to be so nekulturni? Or because to do so would be worse than foolish? It would be wrong? Wrong was a concept foreign to citizens in the Soviet Union. At least, what people perceived as things that were morally wrong. Morality in his country had been replaced by what was politically correct or incorrect. Whatever served the interests of his country's political system was worthy of praise. That which did not was worthy of death? And who decided such things? Men did. Men did because there was no morality, as the world understood the term. There was no God to pronounce what was good and what was evil. And yet, in the heart of every man was an inborn knowledge of right and wrong. To kill another man was wrong. To take a man's life, you had to have a just cause. But it was also men who decided what constituted such cause. The right men in the right place, with the right authority, had the ability and the right to kill because... Why? Because Marx and Lenin said so. That was what the government of his country had long since decided. Zaitsev buttered his last piece of bread and dipped it in the remaining gravy in his bowl before eating it. He knew he was thinking overly deep, even dangerous thoughts. His parent society did not encourage or even permit independent thinking. You were not supposed to question the party and its wisdom. Certainly not here. In the KGB cafeteria, you never ever, not even once, heard someone wonder aloud if the party and the motherland it served and protected were even capable of doing an incorrect act. Oh, maybe once in a while people speculated on tactics, but even then the talk was within limits that were taller and stronger than the Kremlin's own brick walls. His country's morality, he mused, had been predetermined by a German Jew living in London and the son of a czarist bureaucrat who simply hadn't liked the czar much and whose overly adventurous brother had been executed for taking direct action. That man had found shelter in that most capitalistic of nations, Switzerland, then had been dispatched back to Mother Russia by the Germans in the hope that he could upset the czar's government, allowing Germany then to defeat the other Western nations on the Western front of the First World War. All in all, it didn't sound like something ordained by any deity for some great plan for human advancement, did it? Everything Lenin had used as a model for changing his country, and through it, the entire world, had come from a book written by Karl Marx, more writings by Friedrich Engels, and his own vision for becoming the chief of a new kind of country. The only thing that distinguished Marxism-Leninism from a religion was the lack of a godhead. Both systems claimed absolute authority over the affairs of men, and both claimed to be right a priori. Except that his country's system chose to assert that authority by exercising the power of life and death. His country said it worked for justice, for the good of the workers and peasants all around the world. But other men, higher up in the hierarchy, decided who the workers and peasants were, and they themselves lived in ornate dachas and multi-room flats, and had automobiles and drivers and privileges. What privileges they had! Zaitsev had also dispatched messages about pantyhose and perfumes that the men in this building wanted for their women. These items were often delivered in the diplomatic bag from embassies in the West, things his own country could not produce, but which the nomenklatura craved, along with their West German refrigerators and stoves. When he saw the big shots racing down the center of Moscow's streets in their chauffeured Ziegels, then Zaitsev understood how Lenin had felt about the Tsars. The Tsar had claimed divine right as his personal deed to power. The party chieftains claimed their positions by the will of the people. Except that the people had never given anything to them by public acclamation. The Western democracies had elections. Pravda spat upon them every few years, but they were real elections. England was now run by a nasty-looking woman, and America by an aged and buffoonish actor, but both had been chosen by the people of their countries, and the previous rulers had been removed by popular choice. Neither leader was well-loved in the Soviet Union, and he'd seen many official messages sent out to ascertain their mental state and deeply held political beliefs. The concern in those messages had been manifest, and Zaitsev himself had his worries. But as distasteful and unstable as these leaders might be, their people had chosen them. The Soviet people had decidedly not selected the current crop of princes on the Politburo. And now the new communist princes were thinking about murdering a Polish priest in Rome. But how did he threaten the Rodina? This Pope fellow had no military formations at his command. A political threat, then? But how? The Vatican was supposed to have diplomatic identity, but nationhood without military power was... What? If there was no God, then whatever power the Pope exercised had to be an illusion, of no more substance than a puff of cigarette smoke. Zaitsev's country had the greatest army on earth, a fact proclaimed regularly by We Serve the Soviet Union, the TV show that everybody watched. So why do they want to kill a man who poses no threat? Would he part the oceans with a wave of his staff or bring down plagues on the land? Of course not. And to kill a harmless man is a crime, Zaitsev told himself, exercising his mind for the first time in his tenure at No. 2 Dzerzhinsky Square, silently asserting his free will. He'd asked a question and come up with an answer. Would have been helpful if he'd had someone to talk to about that, but of course that was out of the question. That left Zaitsev without a safety valve, a way to process his feelings and bring them to some kind of resolution. The laws and customs of his nation forced him to recycle his thoughts over and over, and ultimately that led in only one direction. That it was a direction of which the state would not approve was, in the end, a product of the state's own making. On finishing his lunch, he sipped his tea and lit a cigarette. But that contemplative act didn't help the state of his mind. The hamster was still running in its wheel. No one in the huge dining room noticed. To those who saw Zaitsev, he was just one more man enjoying his after-meal smoke in solitude. Like all Soviet citizens, Zaitsev knew how to hide his feelings, and so his face gave nothing away. He just looked at the wall clock so that he wouldn't be late going back to work for his afternoon watch. Just one more bureaucrat in a large building full of them. Upstairs, it was a little different. Colonel Rozhdestvensky hadn't wanted to interrupt the chairman's lunch, and so he'd sat in his own office, waiting for the hands on the clock to move, munching on his own sandwich, but ignoring the cup of soup that had come with it. Like his chairman, he smoked American Marlboro cigarettes, which were milder and better made than their Soviet counterparts. It was an affectation he'd picked up in the field, but as a high-ranking first chief directorate officer, he could shop at the special store in Moscow Center. They were expensive, even for one paid-in certificate rubles, but he only drank cheap vodka, so it evened out. He wondered how Yuri Vladimirovich would react to Godarenko's message. Ruslan Borisovich was a very capable resident, careful and conservative, and a man senior enough to be allowed to talk back, as it were. His job, after all, was to feed good information to Moscow Center, and if he thought something might compromise that mission, it was his duty to warn them about it. And besides, the original dispatch had not carried an obligatory directive in it, just an instruction to ascertain a situation. So, no, Ruslan Borisovich would probably not get into any trouble from his reply. But Andropov might bark, and if he did, then he, Colonel A.N. Rozhdestvensky, would bear the noise, which was never fun. His place here was enviable in one way and frightening in another. He had the ear of the chairman, but being that close meant that he had to be close to the teeth, too. In the history of KGB, it was not unknown for some people to suffer for the actions of others. But it was unlikely in this case. Though an undeniably tough man, Andropov was also a reasonably fair one. Even so, it didn't pay to be too close to a rumbling volcano. His desk phone rang. It was the chairman's private secretary.
"The chairman will see you now, Comrade Colonel."
"Spasiba." He rose and walked down the corridor.
"We have a reply from Colonel Godarenko," Rozhdestvensky reported, handing it over. For his part, Andropov was not surprised, and to Colonel Rozhdestvensky's invisible relief, he did not lose his temper.
"I expected this. Our people have lost their sense of daring, haven't they, Alexei Nikolaevich?"
"Comrade Chairman, the resident gives you his professional assessment of the problem," the field officer answered.
"Go on," Andropov commanded.
"Comrade Chairman," Rozhdestvensky replied, choosing his words with the greatest care, "you cannot undertake an operation like the one you are evidently considering without political risks. This priest has a good deal of influence, however illusory that influence may be. Ruslan Borisovich is concerned that an attack on him might affect his ability to gather information, and that, comrade, is his primary task."
"The assessment of political risk is my job, not his."
"That is true, comrade chairman, but it is his territory, and it is his job
to tell you what he thinks you need to know. The loss of some of his agent's services could be costly to us both, in direct and indirect terms.
How costly?
That is impossible to predict. The Rome Residentura has a number of highly productive agents for NATO military and political intelligence information. Can we live without it? Yes, I suppose we could, but better that we should live with it. The human factors involved make prediction difficult. Running agents is an art and not a science, you see.
So you have told me before, Alexei.
Andropov rubbed his eyes tiredly. His skin was a little sallow today, Rozhdestvensky noted. Was his liver problem kicking up again?
Our agents are all people, and individual people have their individual peculiarities.
There is no avoiding it, Rozhdestvensky explained for perhaps the 100th time.
It could have been worse.
Andropov actually listened some of the time. His predecessors had not all been so enlightened. Perhaps it came from Yuri Vladimirovich's intelligence.
That's what I like about signals intelligence, the chairman of KGB groused.
That was what everyone in the business said, Colonel Rozhdestvensky noted. The problem was in getting signals intelligence. The West was better at it than his country, despite their infiltration of the West's signals agencies. The American NSA and British GCHQ, in particular, worked constantly to defeat Soviet communications security, and occasionally, they worried, succeeded at it. Which was why KGB depended so absolutely on one-time pads. They couldn't trust anything else.
How good is this? Ryan asked Harding.
We think it's the genuine article, Jack. Part of it comes from open sources, but most comes from documents prepared for the Council of Ministers.
At that level, they don't lie to themselves much.
Why not? Jack asked pointedly. Everyone else there does.
But here you're dealing with something concrete. Products that have to be delivered to their army. If they do not appear, it will be noted, and inquiries will be made.
In any case, Harding went on, qualifying himself carefully,
the most important material here has to do with policy questions, and for that, you gain nothing by lying.
I suppose. I raised a little hell at Langley last month when I ripped through an economics assessment that was going on to the president's office. I said it couldn't possibly be true, and the guy who drew it up said it was just what the Politburo saw at their meetings.
And you said what, Jack? Harding interrupted.
Simon, I said, whether the big shots saw it or not, it simply could not be true.
That report was total bullshit. Makes me wonder how the hell their Politburo makes policy when the data they base it on is about as truthful as Alice in goddamn Wonderland.
You know, when I was in the Marine Corps, we worried that Ivan Ivanovich, the Russian soldier, might be 10 feet tall.
He isn't.
There may be a lot of them, but they're actually smaller than our people because they don't eat as well as children, and their weapons suck. The AK-47's a nice rifle, but I'll take the M-16 over it any time. And a rifle is a damn sight simpler than a portable radio. So I finally get into CIA and find out the tactical radios their army uses are for shit. And so it turns out I was right about that back when I was a shave-tail butter bar on a green machine. Bottom line, Simon, they lie to the Politburo on what are supposed to be economic realities. And if they lie to those folks, they'll lie about anything.
So, what happened to the report to your president?
They sent it to him, but with 5 pages of mine appended to the back. I hope he got that far. They say he reads a lot. Anyway, what I'm saying is that they base their policy on lies. And maybe we can make better policy by appreciating reality a little bit better. I think their economy is in the shitter, Simon. It can't be performing as well as their data says it is. If it were, we'd be seeing the positive results in the products they make, but we don't, do we? Why be afraid of a country that can't feed itself?
Yep, Ryan nodded.
In the Second World War, in 1941, Russia got invaded by a country that they never liked much, but Hitler was too damn stupid to make their antipathy for their own government work for him. So he implemented racist policies that were calculated to drive the Russian people back into the arms of Joe Stalin. So that's a false comparison, Simon. The Soviet Union is fundamentally unstable. Why? Because it's an unjust society. And there ain't no such thing as a stable, unjust society. Their economy. He paused. You know, there ought to be a way to make that work for us.
And do what?
Shake their foundations some. Maybe a mild earthquake, Ryan suggested.
And bring them crashing down? Harding asked.
His eyebrows went up.
They do have a lot of nuclear weapons, you might want to remember.
Okay, fine. We try to arrange a soft landing.
Bloody decent of you, Jack.
Chapter 7. Simmering. Ed Foley's job as press attaché was not overly demanding in terms of the time required to stroke the local American correspondents and occasionally others. Others included reporters purportedly from Pravda and other Russian publications. Foley assumed that all of them were KGB officers or stringers. There was no difference between the two, since KGB routinely used journalistic covers for its field officers. As a result, most Soviet reporters in America, as often as not, had an FBI agent or two in close attendance, at least when the FBI had agents to spare for the task, which wasn't all that often. Reporters and field intelligence officers had virtually identical functions. He'd just been pinged hard by a Pravda guy named Pavel Kuritsin, who was either a professional spook or sure as hell had read a lot of spy novels. Since it was easier to act dumb than smart, he'd fumbled through his Russian, smiling with apparent pride at how well he'd mastered the complex language. For his part, Kuritsin had advised the American to watch Russian TV, the quicker to master the mother tongue. Foley had then drafted a contact report for the CIA files, noting that this Pavel Yevgenievich Kuritsin smelled like a second chief directorate boy who was checking him out, and opining that he thought he'd passed the test. You couldn't be sure, of course. For all he knew, the Russians did employ people who read minds. Foley knew that they'd experimented in almost everything, even something called remote viewing, which to his professional mind was a step down from gypsy fortune tellers, but which had gotten the agency to start a program of its own, much to Foley's disgust. For Ed Foley, if you couldn't hold it, then it wasn't real. But there was no telling what those panty waists in the Directorate of Intelligence would try, just to bypass what the DO people, the real spooks in CIA, had to do every goddamn day. It was enough that Ivan had eyes, and Christ knew how many years in the embassy, though the building was regularly swept by electronics experts. Once, they'd even succeeded in planting a bug in the ambassador's own office. Just across the street was a former church that was used by KGB. In the U.S. embassy, it was known as Our Lady of the Microchips, because the structure was full of microwave transmitters aimed at the embassy, their function being to interfere with all the listening devices that Station Moscow used to tap into Soviet phone and radio systems. The amount of radiation that came in flirted with dangerous to your health levels, and as a result the embassy was protected with metal sheeting in the drywall, which reflected a lot of it right back at the people across the street. The game had rules, and the Russians pretty much played within them, but the rules often didn't make a hell of a lot of sense. There had been quiet protests to the local natives about the microwaves, but these were invariably met with shrugs of, "Who, us?" And that was as far as it usually went.
The embassy doc said he wasn't worried. But his office was in the basement, shielded from the radiation by stone and dirt. Some people said you could cook a hot dog by putting it on the east-facing windowsills. Two people who did know about Ed Foley were the ambassador and the defense attaché. The former was Ernest Fuller. Fuller looked like an illustration from a book about patricians. Tall, slim, with a regal mane of white hair. In fact, he'd grown up on an Iowa hog farm, gotten a scholarship to Northwestern University, and then a law degree, which had taken him to corporate boardrooms, where he finally ended up as CEO of a major auto company. Along the way, he'd served 3 years in the U.S. Navy in World War II on the light cruiser USS Boise during the Guadalcanal campaign. He was regarded as a serious player and a gifted amateur by the embassy's FSOs. The defense attaché was Brigadier General George Dalton. By profession an artilleryman, he got along well with his Russian counterparts, Fuller asked. Foley shook his head. About what I was briefed to expect. Looks like everywhere I go I have company. How long do you suppose that'll last?
Maybe a week or so.
Take a walk around. Better yet, watch Ron Fielding when he takes a walk. He does his job pretty well. Anything major underway? Ambassador Fuller asked.
No, sir. Just routine operations at the moment. But the Russians have something very large happening at home.
What's that? Fuller asked.
They call it Operation Ryan, their acronym for Surprise Nuclear Attack on the Motherland. They're worried that the president might want to nuke them, and they have officers running around back home trying to get a feel for his mental state.
You're serious? Fuller asked.
As a heart attack. I guess they took the campaign rhetoric a little too seriously.
I have a few odd questions from their foreign ministry, the ambassador said, but I just wrote her off to small talk.
Sir, we're investing a lot of money in the military, and that makes them nervous.
Whereas when they buy 10,000 new tanks, it's normal, General Dalton observed.
Exactly, Foley agreed. A gun in my hand is a defensive weapon, but a gun in your hand is an offensive weapon. It's a matter of outlook, I suppose.
Have you seen this? Fuller asked, handing across a fax from Foggy Bottom. Foley scanned it.
Uh-oh. I told Washington it would worry the Soviets a good deal. What do you think?
I concur, sir. In several ways. Most important will be the potential unrest in Poland, which could spread throughout their empire. That's the one area in which they think long-term. Political stability is their sine qua non.
What are they saying in Washington?
The agency just showed it to the president, and he handed it off to the Secretary of State, and he faxed it to me for comment. Can you rattle any bushes, see if they're talking about it in the Politburo?
Foley thought for a moment and nodded.
I can try.
It made him slightly uncomfortable, but that was his job, wasn't it? It meant getting a message to one or more of his agents, but that was what they were for. The troubling part was that it meant exposing his wife. Mary Pat would not object. Hell, she loved the spy game in the field, but it always bothered her husband to expose her to danger. He supposed it was chauvinism.
What's the priority on this?
Washington is very interested, Fuller said. That made it important, but not quite an emergency tasking.
Okay, I'll get on it, sir.
I don't know what assets you're running here in Moscow, and I don't want to know.
It's dangerous to them.
They shoot traders over here, sir.
This is rougher than the car business, Foley. I do understand that.
Hell, it wasn't this rough in the Central Highlands, General Dalton noted. Ivan plays pretty mean. You know, I've been asked about the president, too, usually over drinks by senior officers.
They're really that worried about him, huh?
It sure looks that way, Foley confirmed.
Good. Never hurts to rattle the other guy's confidence a little. Keep him looking over his shoulder some.
Just so it doesn't go too far, Ambassador Fuller suggested.
He was relatively new to diplomacy, but he had respect for the process.
Okay. Anything that I need to know about?
Not from my end, the COS replied. Still getting used to things. Had a Russian reporter in today, maybe a KGB counter-spook checking me out, a guy named Kiritsin.
I think he's a player, General Dalton said at once.
I caught a whiff of that. I expect he'll check me out through the Times correspondent.
You know him?
Anthony Prince, Foley nodded.
And that pretty much sums him up.
Groton and Yale. I bumped into him a few times in New York when I was at the paper. He's very smart, but not quite as smart as he thinks he is.
How's your Russian?
I can pass for a native, but my wife can pass for a poet. She's really good at it. Oh, one other thing. I have a neighbor in the compound. Hey, Doc. Husband Nigel, wife Penelope. I presume they're players, too?
Big time, General Dalton confirmed. They're solid.
Foley thought so, but it never hurt to be sure. He stood.
Okay.
Let me get some work done.
Welcome aboard, Ed, the ambassador said. Duty here isn't too bad once you get used to it. We get all the theater and ballet tickets we want through their foreign ministry.
I prefer ice hockey.
That's easy, too, General Dalton responded.
Good seats? The spook asked.
First row.
Foley smiled. Dynamite. For her part, Mary Pat was out on the street with her son. Eddie was too big for a stroller, which was too bad. You could do a lot of interesting things with a stroller, and she figured the Russians would be hesitant to mess with an infant and a diaper bag, especially when they both came with a diplomatic passport. She was just taking a walk at the moment, getting used to the environment, the sights and smells. This was the belly of